Hello, everybody. I'm Jennifer Cunningham, class of 92, and I'm here with Professor Valerie Reyna from the School of Human Ecology. Thank you all for joining us today. I'm just going to go through a couple of housekeeping things, and then I'm going to turn it right over to Valerie to start her presentation. She's going to talk for about 20 minutes and talk to you about the adolescent brain, and then we'll take questions for the remainder of the time. You can ask your questions in two different ways. The first is you'll see at the top of your screen a little person with its hand up, and what you need to do is click on that icon, and then we will unmute your phone and you can ask your question. Or you can type your question into the chat, which is right below our faces here, and I will read that question to Valerie as we go along. She's encouraging interactivity, so don't be afraid while she's giving her presentation to chat or raise your hand and we will get your question in. And the success of these webinars really depends on you. This isn't a talk show between Valerie and I. It's all about you and your questions and the interactivity. So I invite you to chime in as much as you can. All right, with that, I will turn it right over to Professor Valerie Reyna.
Thank you very much, Jennifer, and it is a pleasure to communicate with the Cornell community in this new high-tech way. And I'm going to talk today about risky decision-making and the brain, something I'm passionate about, I think, as you will see. And I know that lots of folks have some interesting ideas about this. As I talk to Cornell alumni at different places in the country, they've given me some excellent ideas, so I encourage you to do that and to join in. So, risky decisions. There are a number of different ways that this is defined and so on, but when you think about adolescent decision-making, you think about all the pivotal decisions that young people make in that adolescent period. This is sort of the end of high school and so on. I know, for example, some of you decided to go to Cornell when you were an adolescent. So this is a quote from a play that was on Broadway. And the quote says, "You wake up one morning and realize that your entire adult life was based on a decision of a teenager." So when you think about all of the lifestyle choices, career trajectories, health and exercise, a diet, substance use, many of those things debut in adolescence and they involve risk. And in particular, if you think about some teenagers, the second line of the play is particularly apropos. You wake up one morning, realize your entire life, your adult life was based on the decisions of a stone teenager. That's true only for some people, but it does give one pause about the nature of risky decision-making. So if we think about what a risky decision-making is, there are different definitions depending on the discipline that you hail from. On campus now, we have a number of groups that really overlap economics and decision-making, both in psychology and in human development. So economists, when they talk about risk, and they talk about it a lot because money and investments clearly involve risk, but what they really mean by risk is variance. More than one thing can happen. So if you have a choice between, you know, winning $200 for sure and a 50% chance of winning $300 and a 50% chance of winning $100, that latter thing is a gamble. Of course, you can't lose in a gamble like that. You either win money or you win money. So on the other hand, there's variance in the outcomes for the gamble. And some people just don't like that variance. They don't tolerate risk and uncertainty well. A few people go toward that variance. They like that variance, and they're hoping for that upside potential. Now, psychologists have a similar concept, but mainly they focus on things that involve unhealthy outcomes. Now, the risk comes in when you think about why are people engaging in sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And, of course, the rock and roll part has the sex and the drugs associated with it sometimes, so that's the kind of thing we're talking about. So the idea there is that there are potential benefits, just like there are benefits to getting $300, but there's also a potential downside risk of an unhealthy outcome. Unprotected sex, there's the risk of pregnancy and HIV transmission, and there are other unhealthy outcomes that are associated with impulsivity in adolescence and risky decision making. So that's really the focus of psychology, but as you can see, there are overlaps in these concepts across domains. So when we think about risky decision making, we think about the adolescent drinking and drinking to excess, we think about drug addiction, which often starts in the early adolescent period. But I want you to think more broadly about it, too. What about surgical deciding to have surgery, say knee surgery. You're getting along okay, you know, your walking isn't so good, but should you decide to get an artificial knee? Surgery always has some risk, even if it's a small amount of risk. So how do you make that medical decision? That's a risky decision making. That's risky decision making too. What about the foods that we eat? We say that there's a long-term risk if we engage in certain kinds of eating that our cholesterol will go up, we'll have fats in our blood, and maybe we're taking a risk there too, in which the consequences reveal themselves many years later. What about drugs? You know, the FDA oversees drugs, so it's not that medications are unsafe, but there's always a possibility of side effects, and in some drugs that are very effective, there's a possibility of worse outcomes than that, and patients have to make informed decisions about that risk and uncertainty. There's also people who seek thrills and engage in extreme sports. That's obviously risk-taking. There's driving too fast, especially teenagers tend to engage in reckless driving, driving while drinking, and so on, and naturally that leads to bad outcomes. And then finally, there's the area of financial investing. Do you invest in bonds versus stocks? Well, that depends on your risk tolerance. So all of these domains fall under the heading of risky decision making, and I'm interested in just about all of them and doing research on just about all of them. So why do we care? We care because there are real human and economic consequences. There's human suffering involved. When a young person dies needlessly or is handicapped as a result of a preventable accident, we think to ourselves, could we have prevented that? Is there something we can tell young people that will prevent this morbidity and mortality, as doctors call it? And this is just one statistic I have up on the slide that you know, can give us pause. Teen deaths caused by motor vehicle crashes. Now, 4,544 deaths, not all of them are preventable deaths. Sometimes these really are accidents. But at least a third of the deaths involve alcohol use. There's also other people involved in these crashes who are not adolescents who suffer as a result of perhaps reckless driving, speeding, driving under the influence, and so on. And the cost, the economic cost to the nation is amazing. This is $40.8 billion from this alone, from transportation accidents. Think of all the many, many other causes of preventable morbidity and mortality. And when you begin to think about the bill for all of that, it's huge. Again, our focus is the human suffering and lost potential, but it's important to think about these other outcomes as well. And the bottom line of all of that is we can do better. And by we, I mean society, I mean researchers and the community. These things, if we understand the science of risky decision making, I think we can make a difference. And we've just begun to explore the potential for that. There's tremendous potential to improve the statistics and reduce the suffering out there. So, the Laboratory for Rational Decision Making, that's the name of the laboratory that I head, and I have four italicized there. And that's because we're for rational decision making, and my students and I always joke about that. As I've mentioned, some of the research that we do involves teenagers and their decisions about alcohol, about sex, about food, and about money. We're also interested in health and medical decision making. I study actually physicians' risky decision making. So, for example, when an emergency room physician has to decide whether to admit a patient, most patients who appear at the emergency room door with chest pain actually rule out, meaning that they're not at risk of a heart attack. Maybe they've strained a muscle or have some kind of gastric problem. But it's important, obviously, not to miss the people that really are having a heart attack, and how to support physicians in doing the very best that they can for patients is part of our concern there. I've been done research on what's called numeracy. Numeracy is your knowledge of mathematics and ratios and risks and probabilities, and many millions of Americans, based on representative polls, cannot actually do pretty elementary calculations. For example, they have difficulty computing the dose of a medication for a child. Obviously, if you lack the basic skills to make those computations, there are adverse outcomes that could potentially be associated with that, and in fact have been identified in the literature. I've been working on recently with a wonderful rheumatologist from Yale, work on arthritis and some of these so-called disease-modifying arthritis drugs. These are very complicated drugs, and you may have seen some of the commercials about them. They involve preventing permanent disabilities that, if you prevent them, you know, if you don't prevent these disabilities, you have impairment, your hands and so on, that you can't reverse. On the other hand, the drugs involve some pretty serious but rare risks. So we're interested in that decision and how to help patients do a better job at that. We recently completed an evaluation of a new approach to informing patients about those drugs. And to make a long story short, the statistics went from 35% of real patients making decisions about these drugs that were concordant with their values to almost 64% of patients making decisions that agreed with their own values. So we're very pleased with those preliminary results. We think we can make a difference in this area. And all of this really has to do with informed patient decision making. Vaccination is another controversial area that we've just begun doing some work in. And as you probably know, there's a lot of controversy about some vaccines. Some parents now are refusing to have their children vaccinated. This creates a problem for not only that child, potentially, but also the child sitting next to them in the classroom. So the whole nature of that decision, and if people really understand the risks that they're undertaking and that the risks that society faces as a result of those decisions, we're interested in that as well. So, and then moving out a little bit more broadly, we're also interested in memory and judgment and the relationship between memory and judgment. And if you think about risky decision-making and judgment decision-making, how do you make a decision? Well, you bring that information that's outside your mind inside your mind. And once you do that, we're talking about memory. Memory is kind of the mental scratch pad for decision-making. So decisions are not based on objective reality, the actual facts in a message. They're actually based on what you encode, the pictures in your mind that you form of that information. So that's the relationship between memory, judgment, and decision-making. We're interested in that. We're interested in how it changes across the lifespan, from childhood to old age, to finally, in some cases, mild cognitive impairment, and even in some cases, more profound impairments than that, Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, and so on. So we've just started a series of studies on that, and we have a new grant on that. And then finally, research community partnerships are a big part of my lab. The students and I work together on the basic science, but we also work together in trying to apply the basic science in the real world with real people. We visit many youth programs and schools. We deliver health curricula that are designed to reduce risk-taking. We're involved in communities with older folks as well. So the students get not only the research and scholarly background, but they also get the hands-on interaction with people in the community, and they can see the connection between the laboratory theory and the real-world implications. So this is a picture of my wonderful group, a crew, and as you can see, the caption says, from neurons to neighborhoods, and that really captures the arc of what we're interested in. We're doing new work in neuroimaging at the level of brain computations, what's happening in the mind of the inscrutable teenager, all the way up to the neighborhoods and interacting with people in terms of community programs to reduce risk. So we go from neurons to neighborhoods. That's not an original phrase of mine, but I like it. So it's the title of a National Academy of Sciences report, as a matter of fact, and we think it's very relevant to what we do. So those smiling faces, those young people are the future. These are Cornell students. There's both undergraduate and graduate students. They come from all over, they really make the work worthwhile. They work really hard. We're very intense in our lab. But we have a lot of fun too, and there's a lot of social support as well for people in the lab. So that's the next generation that's going to really make a difference. So I want to talk to you a little bit too about, and Jennifer, you'll tell me when we need to take a pause, right?
I will.
All right, excellent. Because I can go on and on about this. So I want to tell you a little bit also about a new resource at Cornell University. Thanks to the leadership of so many wonderful people, including our dean, We have been able to acquire a magnetic resonance imaging machine, such as the one that you're looking at there. We've got a GE Cigna, a 3 Tesla machine. And what this does is this allows us to image the human brain and also small animals and plants and various other organisms. But I'm particularly interested in the potential of this new facility to really open up and explore some of the mysteries of what's happening in people's minds as they make these risky decisions. And I will be co-directing that facility and encouraging people from all over the university to use it and to implement it in advancing science. So why do we really even want to bother with magnetic resonance imaging or what's called functional magnetic resonance imaging? Well, it allows us to study the human brain without cutting into the skull. This is a mighty good thing. You can study the living, functioning human brain in action as people make decisions, as they engage in certain kinds of tasks that are very revealing about the nature of their thinking. You can study living plants, they don't have to be dead, as well as tissue. And this is really a new way to measure part of reality. If you think about the radical changes that occurred as a result of the discovery of the telescope and the microscope, this is of that ilk. It's a new way to envision reality. It reveals things that we didn't even realize were true. My field, for example, which has to do with the adolescent brain, has really been rocked by discoveries that were made about the nature of the development of the adolescent brain. We thought that adolescents' brains were pretty much developed by adolescents, and that was, you know, the end of the brain development. We've found since then that there's radical restructuring of the brain that occurs in the adolescent period all the way to young adulthood. So I think there's tremendous potential from this new technology, and it's going to be housed in the College of Human Ecology in our building, and we're just very excited about what we can do and what we can measure as a result of this. And as I've indicated before, we can ask new questions and discover new phenomena. Some of the work that we intend to do with the magnet involves linking biomarkers like genetic variations that put people at risk for things like cognitive impairment and Alzheimer's disease, linking that to brain computation and behavior. Naturally, we're going to be looking at the adolescent brain and how it changes in terms of the relationship between the parts of the brain that have to do with self-control and the parts of the brain that have to do with reward responsiveness, temptation, emotion, and so on, and how these interact, and the brain connectivity. And we're interested in some of these recent discoveries about the nature of the brain, how people think about the past versus the future, and so on. New discoveries that have been made possible with the magnetic resonance technology. So one of the things, as I mentioned before, that's been a surprising effect is that we've discovered, as a result of anatomical scans, and these are scans that reveal the morphology of the brain, we found that there's massive pruning of gray matter. That means tissue goes away in development between childhood and adulthood, which is very surprising. There's also a lot of development of white matter connectivity. In other words, the fiber tracts of the brain from the prefrontal cortex are more connected to the reward centers of the brain, the emotional parts of the brain. And the thought there is that this allows this more advanced part of the brain to inhibit and control the urges and passions and wild emotions that characterize adolescence. And that lateral prefrontal cortex, which involves all this pruning, is a late maturing part of the brain. So if we think about it, and this is just a picture to give you a sense of what part of the brain I'm talking about, that DLPFC part is the dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex, and the ventral lateral prefrontal cortex is the VLPFC, and that's mainly what we're talking about in terms of emotion regulation and impulse control and cognitive control and so on. We call this sort of the stop part of the brain as opposed to the go part. And it also involves these deliberative functions, what's called executive processes and so on. So these are the parts of the brain that come in a bit later, and you can see what implications that would obviously have for behavior. Now this particular picture that you're looking at now, if you look on the upper left, you see the number 5. That means 5 years of age. That's what the brain looks like at 5 years of age. And it goes all the way in a series of scans, and this is many, many scans of young people done over a period of time, So we're looking at the five-year-old brain and then the older brain all the way into the 20s. And as you can see from the little ruler on the side, as you get into the blue, it means that the cortical tissue is actually thinner than the red part. So the red and yellow goes away and the brain gets kind of blue. And the reason that the brain is showing up as blue is this is this thinning of gray matter, the pruning or the loss of gray matter tissue, which is, again, a very surprising, massive change between childhood and adulthood. Until we knew that this was a very recent discovery, until we knew that this was going on in the brain, people really had no idea, based on behavior, that they would discover something like this. Now, this next slide is a little busy, but I'm going to walk you through it. On the left, we have what's called amygdala response on the y-axis. The amygdala is part of the brain that has to do with emotional responses. And in this particular study, this has to do with responsiveness to emotional faces. And on the x-axis, along the bottom, you see 5-year-olds all the way up to 35-year-olds. The children are the stars. The adolescents are that grayed-out area that are circles. And the adults are shown on the right. And as you can see, the adolescents respond more to these emotional faces than either the children or the adults. And that's shown on the left. So this notion that perhaps adolescents are more emotional seems to be reflected in this emotion area of the brain. Now on the right, you see the activation to what's called the nucleus accumbens. And if you remember earlier, I mentioned that there's so-called areas of the brain that involve reward. That would be the ventral striatum and the nucleus accumbens. This nucleus accumbens area responds proportionally to reward. So you can actually see the brain light up more to larger rewards that are anticipated, like $20 versus $10, which is pretty cool. And as you can see there, adolescents, again, shown in the middle in that grayed out bar, are showing greater responsiveness to reward on average. But one reason I wanted to show these graphs to you is each one of these dots represents a person. And as you can see, there's variability in the responsiveness of both children and adolescents. Not all of them are hyper-responsive to reward. And that kind of controversy right now in the literature about under-responsiveness and over-responsiveness to reward is actually a major controversy that we're still working on. But these are the kinds of studies when you see in the popular press, people talk about the adolescent brain and how it isn't developed. It's based on this really handful of studies on the responsiveness to reward in certain areas of the brain and the amygdala and the lateral PFC. So, as I mentioned before, there are white matter connections between this lateral prefrontal cortex and the ventral striatum, or this nucleus accumbens reward center. And as these mature, the more mature and connected these are, we've found that there's a connection to that and actual behavior, that young people who have better, stronger connections between these parts of the brain actually score better in measures of impulse control. And we have the example of Simon Says, which I'm sure you played with kids, and that's an example of what we call a go-no-go task, where you have to inhibit responses. You know, when Simon doesn't say it, you're not supposed to go. So that ability to do that has been directly related to this frontostriatal pathway between the frontal parts of the brain and the ventral striatum parts of the brain, which is kind of cool. Now I'm going to show this graph, and then I think I'm due to take a bit of a pause. But I wanted to show it because it involves work done by Cornell students. The second author there, Estrada, is somebody who came from a small town in Texas. He's a graduate student, and he now is working as a professor. There's Jessica DeMarinis, who's another Cornell undergraduate, who's now working as a consultant. Rebecca Myers, who's in Yale Medical School now. Janice Stanich, who's now in law school, Brooklyn Law School, and she just found out about her summer internship, so she's really pleased. She stays in touch, too. They all do. And Britton Mills, who was a graduate student here and now works in a medical school. So I'm pretty proud of them, and they generated the curve that you're looking at right there. And as you can see, there's a curvilinear pattern on the bottom, and that says sensation seeking. That's about the responsiveness to reward again, as measured by instruments that have to do with thrill seeking and so on. So that's a significant curvilinear relationship, which means it peaks in adolescence. You're the most thrill-seeking, sensation-seeking in adolescence, and that gradually goes down as you get older. On the other hand, the ability to inhibit yourself, BIS, behavioral inhibition scale, that goes steadily upwards. And as you can see on the right, you begin to get that separation between the responsiveness to rewards and the ability to control yourself. And you can see that if you're less tempted and have better self-control, naturally you would engage in healthier behavior. So this allows us to look under the hood, if you will, and to understand the mechanisms underlying risky decision making. So Jennifer, is this a good time to pause?
This would be a great time to pause.
All right.
And Simon says, ask some questions.
All right.
People on the phone. So again, to do that, you can either write a chat in, or you can ask a question by clicking on the white icon at the top with the person who has their hand raised, and we'll be on the phone. I see some people are typing while they're doing that. I have a question for you, Valerie, a little bit beyond Cornell. You work with all kinds of national boards, the U.S. Department of Education, the National Institute of Health, Science Foundation, National Academy of the Sciences. So clearly the work you're doing and just the field in general is getting some attention. Can you talk a little bit about that? And is it a new thing that people are paying attention to risk and decision making? Or what is Cornell advancing that interest? Or how's that working?
Well, there's been a longstanding interest in risky decision making because it obviously has clinical implications. But I can definitely say there's been a surge lately of research. Part of it is really inspired by the research on the adolescent brain. There's so much we didn't know about the development of the adolescent brain. And then also, federal agencies are asking scientists for advice about how to support research that will help reduce some of these unhealthy outcomes. So I serve on an FDA committee on risk communication. This is a new committee. There really weren't behavioral scientists advising the FDA on how to communicate with people. So this committee, the purview of it ranges from the inserts in medication, how to list those side effects so that they're comprehensible by people, so that people really can engage in what's called patient-informed shared decision-making, all the way to, you know, as you know now, the FDA has some regulatory ability for the information that goes out on the side of cigarette packs and so on. So there's really a renewed interest in the adolescent risky decision-making area, but also in the policies that we can develop that, as a result of understanding the human mind, that will result in better outcomes for society.
Right. I actually just heard a report on NPR today that only a third of doctors talk to their patients about obesity, and the woman on there was giving all sorts of reasons why they don't do it, and I thought of you and wondered if you had any influence over that report.
Well, as a member of a community, I think the community as a whole certainly has some influence, and we are doing research on obesity. And again, we realize the magnitude due to the wonderful research by many people. We have a sense of that this is an immense, public health problem. And now that we really have some sense of the scope of it, there's renewed attention to it. And part of the issue, though, is that people really need evidence-based interventions. We know that behavior and food choices have a lot to do with this. Genetics and other biological factors are certainly important, but these are often modifiable behavioral factors. When we looked, for example, to see whether there was any curriculum at the high school level that was based on a randomized control trial design, where you really know, cause and effect, where you do this kind of curriculum, it results in a reduction in obesity. We couldn't find any. There just weren't any randomized controlled trial designs. So we decided to take a well-known curriculum and to do the first one. We now have preliminary results on that look good. We now want to use some of the theoretical approaches we've developed here at Cornell to enhance that curriculum so that it has a greater impact on behavior.
Nice. Okay, we have a question from Ellen Morehouse. How is sensation seeking related to temperament?
Well, that's a really good question. Sensation seeking has to do with your level of what's called biological arousal, and it is considered an aspect of temperament and personality. It's one that people have studied for a number of years, and there's some evidence, again, that it peaks in adolescent, but many of the things said about sensation seeking, we know adolescents, for example, are more sensation seeking than young adults and so on. But just exactly how that interacts with self-control, with brain development, all of that is really new work and new vistas for research. So sensation seeking seems to be what's called a stable individual difference. Some people just are more that way than others. Most of us transition in adolescence and become less sensation seeking. But a sizable number of people remain thrill seekers and sensation seekers, and this really influences their injury, traumatic injury rate, and all kinds of other behaviors can be predicted from that pretty robustly.
Huh. Okay, Susie Heilman has a question. Did you read Jonah Lehrer's article in the Wall Street Journal this weekend? He notes that the insula, seen in the fMRI, is also activated by feelings of disgust and bodily pain and coordinates hand movement. How do we know that what we're seeing is correctly interpreted?
Oh, I can I have you in my class? That's exactly the right question to ask, and thank you so much for caring about the answer. That's very, very important. One of the approaches that we're taking in neuroimaging is we actually conduct experiments in the brain imaging device. And much of the research is correlational in nature. It says, and there's a lot of research on the insula that supports this generalization about disgust, so that you can correlate self-reports of disgust as an experience with activation in the insula. But as we know, and as we teach our students, correlation does not necessarily imply causation. So we really want to get a handle on the causal mechanisms behind these parts of the brain and have a model of what exactly are they doing as opposed to only correlation. So what we've tried to do is actually test hypotheses about what we think different parts of the brain are doing and do experiments and see whether the brain responds in a kind of parametric, almost dose response way to the kinds of manipulations that we present experimentally, because we think that gives us much more rigorous evidence of cause and effect. And this is obviously a story that's still unfolding about parts of the brain. There's many things we're still uncertain of, but this exact kind of focus is something we want to emphasize at Cornell.
Ellen Schultz asks, does the work you're doing at Cornell intersect with Abigail Baird at Vassar?
Yes, indeed. Abigail Baird is someone who I've invited to conferences and whose work I cite. And she's terrific. She did some early work that was actually very influential for me personally in my research program. And she showed that if you present sentences like, it's a good idea to set your hair on fire, true or false? it's a good idea to eat a salad, true or false? That these good ideas and bad ideas, the good news is that both adolescents and adults said it's a bad idea to set your hair on fire, it's a bad idea to swim with sharks, and other things like that, that really are bad ideas. However, there were systematic differences between the responses of the adolescents and the adults. For example, the adolescents thought about it. They took longer to reply, yes, it's a bad idea to swim with sharks. This is discomforting. So they're thinking about it, and the parts of the brain that lit up were actually those deliberative parts of the brain that I mentioned earlier. So they're actually calculating the risks. They're thinking, well, there's a potential thrill, and setting your hair on fire, I don't know what the thrill would be there, but these kinds of things engage logical computational faculties. But in adults, the areas that lit up were things like the fusiform. So if you met, the fusiform is identified with things like pictures in your mind. So a good idea to swim with sharks. They probably have a big picture of Jaws in their mind that's lighting up. And the answer is no bad idea, fast reaction time. So Abigail Baird's work is part of the work that I built some of the newer ideas that I have about risky decision making on.
Okay, we have a few people typing their questions. And again, while they're doing that, I'll ask a question. You mentioned the neurons to neighborhoods. As I understand it, human ecology is one of the draws about it is how you use the applied science to service to real life method. And I just wondered, is that something so in the forefront of your mind when you're designing curriculum and recruiting students, recruiting faculty, that the idea of bringing your research to the real world? How do you sell that? How do you incorporate that into what you're doing?
Well, you know, usually translational approaches where you take the basic science and you apply it to the real world, you don't usually have to sell students on that. They really like that.
Okay.
They find that very relevant. And our lab is kind of a little strange because there's certainly laboratories that work solely on basic science at Cornell, and there's laboratories that work mainly on applied problems at Cornell. We really like to work on both and on the border between them. So there's a famous saying, there's nothing so practical as a good theory. And I think that's very, very true. Mm-hmm. It's very important not to abandon the basic science aspect of things, because mm-hmm. if you really understand why people are doing what they're doing, you can help them much more effectively,
right.
and you can design interventions that are customized to the kinds of factors that go on. If you really, it's a black box and you don't understand, you can maybe do something that works by accident, by trial and error, but the utility, the breadth of application, the degree of response to that will be much less than if you really understand the mechanisms.
Hey, Reginald White has a question. How does your research affect the theories which say that our personality and behavioral traits are formed by age 20 and do not change much in adulthood?
Well, again, before the recent work, there was a little bit more support for that, but I think it's really a question of, it's an empirical question. And one of the things that's a theme of my work is that we can change these things. Mm-hmm. We can intervene with adults. And like I said, the study that I mentioned about rheumatoid arthritis was done with adult patients. And 35% value concordant decisions to 64% with a very simple, cost-effective intervention. So I've done these kinds of interventions with children with different processes, of course. Mm-hmm. With doctors and so on, we say, well, doctors won't accept, you know, new ways of doing things. Well, yeah, they do if you can present an evidence-based reason or rationale for the change in behavior, and you can bridge that gap between the way they're doing things now and an intuitive approach that makes sense to them. So I would say no. I think behavior is quite changeable. Are there early experience effects? Absolutely. So, you know, some of the preschool claims that are made are quite valid, but you can change people's behavior. You just have to have the right theory and the right mechanisms and the right intervention.
So part of that question was the personality. Are mm-hmm. personality and behavior two separate things, or do you consider them one thing?
I think they're two separate things. Personality, there's evidence for personality differences like extroversion, introversion, you know, mm-hmm. shyness and outgoingness from early on in infancy, and I'm sure that's probably part of what the questioner is asking me about. So there's evidence for early personality differences. However, how those differences are acted on and developed and result in behavior vary a great deal and depend on environmental mm-hmm. factors that affect the individual later on. And sometimes there are these changes there where people start off one way and end up a different way.
Mm-hmm.
So that does happen. It's not immutable.
Olivia Ann Golan Hope, sorry if I'm screwing up that last name, would you please speak to the correlation between ADD and the latent developmental timeline of the frontal cortex?
Well, I'm not an expert on ADD, but there's a lot of good research on ADD and brain development now. Obviously, it's a focus of research, given the base rate of ADD, which is very, very high. There are connections I know in terms of attention issues with folks who develop autism and so on that have to do with definite changes in brain development. Overgrowth of connections, for example, is characteristic of the autistic brain. And in ADD, I know that there's been new work that has moved that ball forward. I don't think we have any definitive answers yet on ADD, but I know it's a very important focus. And I know one of our faculty, for example, teaches a course that relates to that area.
Hmm. Well, speaking of faculty, how do you recruit your faculty? What is it a competitive field out there? Where do you get most of them?
Well, it certainly is competitive. On the other hand, our department and college has, and the university, from what I understand, has been really fortunate to have leadership that's thinking ahead
mm-hmm.
and thinking about the turnover in professors that's going to happen. And we're actively recruiting and hiring now. We've hired a number of new people in my department alone. So many new people that the word has really gotten out that we really, you know, are on the cutting edge.
Mm.
We've hired a new person from Harvard University who's one of the world emerging leaders in the area of brain connectivity, for example, and we're interviewing a couple more candidates in the coming weeks. It's a time-consuming process, but it's an investment in the future mm. for Cornell. So it's certainly, we've been perceived as being very actively hiring, and that's really good for Cornell to be perceived that well, and it's a wonderful time to look for people. Because of the nature of the economy, it means that we really have an excellent choice.
Mm-hmm.
We would anyway, but we have even more, I think, of a market that we can draw from. And we're very excited about that.
Nice. Okay. On the flip side, can you talk a little bit about the students that are interested in this? Do they come to Cornell knowing that this is something they want to do, or how do you instill in them that this is a worthy line of study, and then what do they do when they leave?
Well, students at Cornell are remarkable. A lot of them come in and they know that the brain is very important. They've already been reading in neuroscience as high school students. Not everyone, but it's remarkable how many really are actively interested in that. We draw on people interested in medicine, like I have a number of students in my lab who want to be neurosurgeons. Mm-hmm. We have people who want to be clinical psychologists and social workers, and they all realize that the human brain is so important to the kinds of behaviors they're going to be dealing with. I even had a student who's a presidential scholar who came to me as a freshman. He'd actually done neuroimaging research himself as a high school student, which is pretty amazing. But we all learn together, and we've actually had students now in my laboratory do neuroimaging research. And if I get an opportunity to show you those scans at some point, I'd love to. But the students really are very hungry and eager to get that kind of training. Now, of course, it requires resources. Mm-hmm. This kind of thing with the neuroimaging is you can't just sort of walk out and do it. You've got to have the facilities and the personnel. But we've managed to get some cutting edge training for these students, both graduate students and undergraduates. And most of them approach me interested in it, actually.
Nice. Yeah. Okay, Salmeen Hamid has a question. Does your research help those with OCD, which is obsessive compulsive disorder? Can they change behavior over time? As they get older, are they able to cope better?
OCD is not an area that I do research in. I do research in a vast range of things, but not in OCD. So I really shouldn't, you know, ethically really speak to that. I know a lot of people are working on that, and I know that both medication and behavioral therapies are used in tandem for that, and they've gotten some very promising results so far. It's far from a solved problem, though.
Olivia has a great question. Does the increased use of electronics by teenagers affect the brain in terms of increased risky behavior?
There's some preliminary correlational research that's slightly suggestive that the multitasking and the learning of information processing that's, you know, intermittent and small little chunks and rapid changes, that may be affecting the information processing of the brain. Most of that research is not quite at the level where we can make cause and effect inferences from it. It's suggestive and interesting, and it's possible that these habits that are developed of constantly being stimulated in multiple different simultaneous ways, that might have effects on information processing style. But again, the jury is out on the final conclusions on that.
Okay, great. So I noticed in the picture of your students there were a lot of males in there, and a lot of the people on this call were here in the 60s, 70s, 80s when it was mostly female. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about that? Are you actively recruiting males, or is it pretty even in your...
It's actually, there's usually more women in my lab in general. The base rate is higher of women. I think that there certainly are stereotypes that still are out there to some degree about areas like neuroscience. And I actively encourage young women as well as young men to feel that this technology is something that they can master. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I have to encourage some women students to step up into this area because it seems very formidable. There's a lot involved in data analysis, a lot involved in the technology itself. But I find it a pleasure to do that, to encourage women to go into science and to go into... And I considered psychological science the way we practice it, and human development the way we practice it, to be a hard science. Mm-hmm. So I delight in doing that, and in general, to encourage young people to master things and to develop that confidence that comes from really, really solving difficult problems.
Great. Another thing that Cornell is well known for is the collaboration among all the colleges. And I just wonder, do you work with other colleges or with Weill Medical at all?
Absolutely. I have an appointment in public health at Weill Medical School, and I'm about to go and give a talk there actually in February on the 16th. And I of course know the work of a number of the people at Weill Medical School, and I've enjoyed meeting them and engaging them, and we're planning to do collaborative research. Mm-hmm. We also, I direct a center for behavioral, co-direct a center for behavioral economics and decision research. and that involves economists, sociologists, psychologists, developmentalists, and people from other disciplines who get together and think about decision research as well. And I'm very stimulated by interdisciplinary research. Okay. I think it's there's a lot of promise in making new discoveries by working with other people.
Well, I know you just gave this talk in Rochester, mm-hmm. And you're doing this webinar. It seems to me that alumni are hungry to hear more about what you do and what your lab is doing. Do you have any suggestions for the people on the phone who want to stay involved other than maybe being research subjects?
Well, and I wouldn't, you know, if you have been a subject in one of our studies, thank you. Mm-hmm. Without you, we couldn't do the work. So you really are making a difference. And students love interacting, I know, with the subjects and so on. I think that's part of their training, too, which is very valuable. I think there are also websites that I think Jennifer can send out to people in which you can see lectures that have been taped based on the work in the lab and see what some of the students are working on too.
Okay, great. Well, I don't see any more questions from the field. So is there anything else that we haven't talked about that you would really like the alums on the phone to know about?
Oh, goodness, there's so much I always like to talk about. You never get a professor started lecturing because, you know, it's... I would just like to say that I think that there is a tremendous promise to make a difference in the world. We're really on the edge of so many new discoveries and things like impulsivity, autism, risky decision making, cognitive impairment. Some of the work that we've done recently shows, for example, that you can predict impairment better with some of the behavioral tests even than with the genetic markers. Mm-hmm. And what we're hoping to do is put those two together and really improve prediction. And obviously, if you measure and assess cognitive abilities better, you can develop treatments much more effectively. And in particular, I should point out that I know we're all aging, no matter what age we are, we're all in the process of aging, and it's important to note that there are cognitive faculties that are preserved in aging that people can rely on to make good decisions, and that if we separate out these measures, we can find the hidden strengths that people have and help them build on them much more effectively. So we're very excited about the potential for that research too.
Great. Okay, what's the favorite part of this job for you?
Oh goodness. Well, I just love being a professor because there's multiple things I like. I love working with students, and one of the things that I really treasure is the opportunity to work with them individually in the laboratory. Our dean and associate dean have really supported that. They realize that that's very time intensive. But the ability to have a lab where we can actually do the work together is I love that. Every day I spend mostly doing that is always a good day. Mm-hmm. So that's very exciting. I'm very passionate about that. Very gratifying. And then I love doing the research itself. I think it's something that I feel draws on my abilities, and I've been so privileged as a result of Cornell and other folks out there who are part of the scientific community that we together can really make a difference, and that's also very gratifying.
Yeah. Salmin Hamid has a question about are there distinct differences between male and female behavior? Do males take more risks?
Well, there's debate about that. Certainly, if you break it down into types of risk-taking, there clearly are gender differences, physical risk-taking versus other kinds of risk-taking. And most recently, we actually did a study on this where we thought we would get some gender differences, and indeed we did. And this involved what's called delay of gratification or temporal discounting. So in other words, if I gave you $100 today versus $200 in a year, would you wait a year to get the $200 or would you go for the quick cash right now? So that ability to delay gratification is an individual difference that also predicts many important economic and educational outcomes. So we did a study where we changed the item that you're making decisions about. So for some of the decisions involved decisions about chocolate and candy bars. So I think you could know exactly where I'm going in terms of the stereotypes. So, you know, one candy bar today or six candy bars in a month, that kind of thing, versus alcohol, one drink now versus six drinks in a month, and money and various other kinds of things. And as you probably can predict, There was more effects of reward, less ability to wait when it involved chocolate for women and alcohol for men, which is kind of what we expected. And we also look at things like how many of our young people have problems with alcohol and other kinds of substances like this. And indeed, it's a large proportion of college students, and that's true at any university, who actually are drinking way too much alcohol. In our sample, about 20% really were classified as problem drinkers. Which is a bit of a problem. Now, that drinking goes down after they graduate from college, typically, but for some people it doesn't, and that's one of the reasons. So, although there's a kind of amusing gender interaction here that we're interested in, there's also, you know, a real life concern that underlies this.
Right. So Olivia has a question about if teens' brains are wired for risk, is there a way for parents to impact brain development to reduce such behavior? Also, do you have any suggestions for parents of students who exhibit at-risk behaviors?
Oh, goodness. Yes, there are things you can do. First of all, it's important to let the parents out there know that you are a significant influence on your teen. Most of us, if you in the popular media, you see a lot of emphasis on peers influencing teens, but actually parents are the number one influence on teens. And this is both by self-report of teens as well as looking behaviorally. So you really do make a difference in your teen's life. I wrote a review of the literature in 2006, which is available free on the web. It's open access. The authors are Reina and Farley, 2006, and we can make that available to you as well. And in table four of that paper, there's a list of recommendations based on the evidence that's reviewed in that paper. And there are a number of things that you can do. I think media does have an effect, so the kinds of role models experienced in movies, in novels, and so on, actually has an effect on behavior. For young adolescents who are not there yet in terms of their ability to make risky decisions, it's very important to have supervised and monitored time, where we're not putting young people in the position of having to be, you know, good decision makers when they're not really ready yet. So that ability to transition from being monitored and supervised to being more autonomous, that's a process that occurs from early adolescence to young to older adolescents. But for some young people, it's better to not have the opportunity to make those cataclysmic decisions until you're ready. The brain is still developing, after all.
Right. So how about non-risk behaviors? Like, how do we get our kids to come to Cornell?
Well, remember what I said about the fateful decisions of the teenager ramifying through your life. I would invite people to visit Cornell. I think once you visit Cornell and you meet the faculty, you meet the students here, I think that's probably the best way to make that decision. We often welcome young people to visit our lab and see what we do and so on. Mm-hmm. So I would encourage you to do that.
Neat. Okay. All right. Well, we will make all the websites that Professor Reina mentioned available. We'll be sending you a survey shortly after this conference ends, and you can tell us about your experience. And again, we will also put the links to a lot of the websites. And Susie Heilman says thank you. So thank everyone on the phone for joining us today. And if you have any other questions, you can just reply to the email that we'll send you, and we'll get those to Professor Reina. So thank you, everybody.
Thank you so much, and it's been a pleasure.